I have had worse experiences of racism in the UK and Europe than I have ever had in the States. Ever.
Welcome back to another episode of Conversations with Nova Reed. I love that I get to spend time with you. I appreciate your time and for choosing to spend the next hour or so with me. I don't take that for granted. So thank you for choosing to share this corner of the internet with me, and a shout out to my Patreons for supporting this little project that is not funded. And so any little donation helps towards being able to run the podcast, and it's great to have your support. So thank you. It feels quite apt for me to share this conversation I had with Daniel Edmund today as we talk about how summer 2020 was one of the hardest years of his life. And today is the anniversary of the murder of George Floyd. And whilst death and murders at the hands of police brutality is not something that is new or unique to George Floyd, and it's certainly not something that has stopped since George Floyd and continues to persist, it was the moment where we had a global spotlight on racial justice that hasn't occurred before. And Daniel Edmund was one of the people who was leading Black Lives Matter protests in Bristol. And so I share a bit more about who he is in his world and also what that period of time was like for him, given his role and who he is as a black man. And we also reflect on a year and really talk about what has changed. And we also talk about how little has changed. This episode, it is rich, it is raw, and it is incredibly human. And I just want to give an invitation to people who are listening who are on their anti-racism journey, either deep in it or right at the beginning and scratching the surface, to lean into any discomfort that comes up in this episode, because I suspect it will. We are having a very unfiltered conversation about the impact of racial trauma and the impact of friends, relationships, so that could be co-workers, not doing anti-racism work. And we do not mince our words. So it's an invitation to witness, bear witness, and also just to be mindful and pay attention to what goes on and what comes up for you. Daniel and I cover, I mean, there's no stone left unturned in this conversation. And I actually, you know, I want to thank Daniel for sharing such a huge part of his heart with me. We go from everything from toxic masculinity and the work that Daniel does and has done in men's mental health, addressing toxic masculinity. We weave into gender expression, trauma, spirituality, and collective healing. And I think ultimately what this conversation highlights is the very real and dangerous impact on well-being, sense of self, humanity, wider humanity, when people are not able to be their whole selves. This is a conversation and a half. Tune in, take care of yourself, and as ever, I'd love to know what you think. You can find me over at Instagram at Nova Reed Official. Let's go over to the episode. Before we dive on in, I just want to leave a content and trigger warning for those that this information might be useful to. Some of the content my guest shares includes themes of suicide, drug misuse, body dysmorphia, and he also uses racist and homophobic language to depict lived experience. So just use that as you see fit and take care of yourself. Welcome back to another episode of Conversations with Nova Reed. My goodness, what a treat you are in for today. I am joined by incredible speaker, presenter,
social entrepreneur and filmmaker, Daniel Edmond. Wow, thank you so much for joining me.
No, but thank you so much for having me. This is an honor. Thank you so much for inviting me here. I cannot wait to speak to you.
Oh, what an intro. Thank you so much. So I'm going to dive right on in. How are you?
First of all, thank you for asking. And I am coming to you today in this moment, grounded, thankful, grateful, traumatized, saddened with grief, but also feeling incredibly powerful and strong as well. And so it's a mix of different feelings and emotions I have right now.
Yeah.
But ultimately, I feel grounded and grateful. There are a variety of different personal traumas that I'm working through right now, and collective family traumas. But I'm coming to you grateful and grounded, like I said, and I'm looking forward to a good conversation. The last time we spoke in person was literally last year or 2 years ago.
2 years, yes.
2 years ago.
2019.
Yes.
My goodness. And firstly, I just want to acknowledge, thank you for giving me such a human and honest response to that question. We're so many of us are disconnected from parts of our humanity, and thank you. That was a real beautiful and human response, and I appreciate you sharing that with me. Thank you.
Of course, of course.
So the backstory, my friends, Daniel and I met on International Women's Day in March 2019.
Yes.
And I found Daniel was one of a few men there, and he was on a panel talking mostly about toxic masculinity and mental health, I think, or mental yes. health in men. And, you know, the role of women in who we are raising. I don't know if you want to share more about that, because I know you're doing lots of other things now, but I just remember feeling just very pulled by you and your sincerity in at that event.
Well, thank you. And honestly, I had a great time at that event. You know, it was a really good time, and getting to meet people like yourself. But yeah, I remember that panel. I was speaking about the male community, toxic masculinity, and I think as well, men's role within the dynamic of patriarchy and yes. the state that women oftentimes find themselves in around the world, you know. And so really having, you know, prefacing all of it with the fact that men still carry the majority of the power in almost every industry and culture in the world, that actually is incredibly important that as men, we one, recognize that, and we recognize the privilege that we carry, but also we recognize that how our actions impact everyone else. Like yes. that is so incredibly important. And then not just leaving it there, but also recognizing and actively working on redistributing power. And so that part is really important. If you're doing work without redistributing power, then you really aren't working towards dismantling systemic inequality. Yeah. There has to be a redistribution of any type of power and influence and authority in different spaces. So for me, I worked the past 6 years working with a company that I started, actually. And so I started a company called Milk for Tea. And then which I no longer work with right now. But went back when we met, I was working with that and working in men's well-being to help better the experiences for women, LGBTQ+, and men themselves. And so it was a great time. I worked in that. I worked with that company for 6 years. I started it from the ground up, and I feel really blessed and fortunate to have the experience that I had with it. I've now transitioned and moved on and doing other things that I'm sure we'll get into later on. Yeah. But yeah, that event was great, and I'm very grateful for my time there.
Thank you. I'm jumping around a bit, but play along with me. Who are you beyond your roles?
Beyond my roles, that's a great question. I love that. Beyond my roles. Beyond my roles, I am a very loving, a very kind, a very sensitive man. I do identify as a man, but even more so than that, you know, I'm a spiritual, mental, emotional, and physical being that is really rooted in transparency and honesty and truth telling, and showing up in this world in an authentic way that is honoring to who I am and to my soul. Mm. And it's interesting because over the past year, I've really been getting a good understanding of my soul and really understanding and really meeting and getting to know my soul more. You know, when we look in the mirror, we see our physical self. And, you know, our mental self is with us, you know, a lot of the times. And mental health has been a big aspect of the past few years with many of us in the mainstream conversations that are happening around mental health. And I think even emotional health now, you know, a lot of people are speaking more on that, which is a great thing. But this, over the past year, I've really been getting to know my soul, like really like understanding like, wow, Daniel, this is your soul. This is what your soul is like. These are the attributes and characteristics of your soul, you know, and for me, I've really been connecting more with my ancestral spirituality. I come from African heritage. And so understanding, you know, that I, you know, on a soul level, I believe that I chose to come here to this earth. And I believe that I came here with a purpose and a mission. And through that, through understanding my purpose and my mission, I'm understanding my soul more. And it's almost like I'm able to look at the mirror of my soul through what I'm doing now. Wow. And understanding and connecting more with my ancestors as well. My grandparents on my dad's side who are no longer with me, I've really been connecting with them more. And again, really honoring them by living my truth. And so I'm very rooted, much rooted, you know. So to answer your question, who am I beyond my roles? I aim to be truth. I aim to be transparency. I aim to be love. And I aim to be a change in this world, a change maker in this world. And so that starts with me and my family. You know, right now, my family and I are doing some very deep collective healing work right now.
Powerful.
Yes. It's challenging and yeah. But it's beautiful and so honoring of our ancestors and everyone who's come before us and honoring of ourselves. So that's what I would say. You know, I don't know. That may be a bit too abstract. I hope not. But
no.
That's who I am. And I have, you know, my dad says all the time, my dad's a speaker as well. He's a pastor in the Christian faith. And yeah. And so, but he always, whenever he speaks about his children, me being one of them, he always says, you know, Daniel has taught me about transparency.
Mm.
And I think that is one, like, that's just part of my DNA. It's yeah. truth telling and honesty and transparency and just living that out.
Yeah, you role model it. You role model that beautifully. So thank you for diving in. If you feel comfortable to share more about where you grew up and what that was like.
For sure. So I was born in Bristol, England. And so I'm a Bristol boy. My dad is British Caribbean. My grandparents are Jamaican. I came over to the UK during the Windrush generation in the 50s. And so, yeah, I was actually born in Bristol. My mother is American. So I'm actually half, I'm British Caribbean and also African American.
Mm-hmm.
And so my mother's American. She's from Washington, D.C.
Mm-hmm.
My father ended up going to university in the States and met my mother. They moved back to the UK and had my brother and I. When I was about 3 or 4, my mom got homesick and we moved back to the States.
Ah.
And then I was raised in the States for most of my life. And then I moved back to the UK about 10 years ago. So okay. it's kind of like a bit back and forth. Like I said, I have dual citizenship. And so I do consider myself British Caribbean and African American. And I there are a lot of different aspects and cultures that help to make up who I am as a person.
Yeah.
My family is very international. It's a very multicultural family. But yes, I spent the majority of my upbringing in the States. And I would come over to the England during the summers and stuff like that a lot of the times. But a lot of my upbringing was in the States, in Maryland, just outside of Washington, D.C. And it was a very interesting trajectory for me, you know, in terms of how I've gotten to where I am now. You know, growing up, it was just, you know, and this is so interesting because it's a lot of, you know, it really speaks to a lot of the work I'm doing right now. Mm-hmm. But there have always been this real big discussion around race, gender, and sexuality in my life,
mm-hmm.
particularly around gender and sexuality, especially in the early years. But mm-hmm. race, you know, as a Black man, race is always there. You know, yeah. that's just a given. But from a very young age, I was made very aware around these concepts or these mainstream concepts of gender and sexuality. you know, yes. I was a very effeminate kid, you know, for in terms of what people thought, you know, viewed me as. I was very in touch with my emotions. I was very sensitive, as I am now. And I always tell people, I have not changed. Like, I am still that guy, you know, because people are always like, oh, he'll grow out of it. I'm like, no, this is who I am. This is my soul, you know? And so I was always, you know, just very in touch, you know, with my emotions. And most of my friends were girls growing up. And I was just, I loved good conversation. I've always been this way, you know. I find people very fascinating. And I care about people and, you know, and so because of that, it went so much against the grain of what a lot of people expected a boy to be like, that I was labeled gay from a very early age. So like, literally, I don't remember a time in my life where I have not been called gay. Someone has speculated that I was gay. And I just do not know a time in my life where that was not the case. And the thing is, when people were interrogating me in that way, one, it's not for them to interrogate. But also, two, they were not interrogating in a way to support me. They were interrogating in a way to attack me. And so that was really challenging for me because it was an attack. It was, you're gay was an attack. It wasn't seen as a positive thing. And that was from a variety of different people, not just my peers. There were adults, you know, everyone. And so for me, and the interesting thing about that, I'll say, you know, just to add to that, is the fact that it wasn't that I wasn't into anything that was stereotypically male. I was into, I've been an athlete for the majority of my life. I was into a lot of things that were, that things considered to be typically male or for boys. And I say that, you know, generally
speaking. In quotes,
for boys, whatever that means for people. But it's the fact that I also was so in touch with my the feminine part of who I am. That's what they did. So it wasn't as if they, you know, and I grew up in a time, you know, and I sound like, you know, I sound like I'm really old, but, you know, I grew up, you know, but, you know, the feminine in men was not, and in boys, it was not very much honored. And to be honest, it still isn't in many ways. It's still not. And for me, you know, I've always embodied a lot of feminine energy, you know, because, and it's not even about just embodying it. It's respecting and honoring the feminine that's inside of me.
Yes.
And I've always been tapped into it. And, but a lot of people didn't understand that about me. And they tried to attack me. And I'm really grateful that I have such great parents and parents who really honor me and allowed me to be myself. And, particularly my mother, you know, she really allowed me to lean into it. I remember vividly being probably in the first grade, so I must have been about six, maybe five or six. And I remember that we were going school supply shopping, and we would, you know, for school, we'd need to get these folders and stuff like that, to, you know, what we call in the States binders, but like to put your papers in and stuff like that. And there was this, I always loved Pocahontas. I was a big Pocahontas fan, big Little Mermaid fan. I absolutely love them. But Pocahontas has always been a really key figure for me. And so I remember we were at the shop and there was this Pocahontas folder and I saw it and it was like, she was there, her hair was blowing in the wind. And I was like, oh, this is incredible. I have to have this folder. And I went to my mom and said, Mom, can I have this one? And she said, sure. And I asked her, even at that age, I must have been about five or six, and I wasn't just asking if I could have the folder. I was asking if I could have this particular one.
Yes.
And even at that age, I knew that there was some sort of dissonance between me being a boy and me wanting this folder. Yes. And so the permission I was asking wasn't just, can I physically have this folder? It was, can I have this Pocahontas folder, even though I'm a boy? Mm. And she said, yeah, of course you can have it, you know? And it's interesting because I was so excited. I was grateful. And so when I went to school, we had to give the folders to the teacher. And then each day we would keep the folders at the school in class. And the teacher would call our names each morning and we'd have to come and collect them. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting because when I got to class, the first time that they called my name out, it was in front of everyone. We'd sit on the ground and they would call out our names. I remember feeling so embarrassed that I had the folder. And no one had really said anything to me, but I was so embarrassed. Even at that age, five or six, I knew that there was something, I knew that I was somehow not supposed to have this folder, you know?
Yes.
And to be honest, even though I don't remember someone saying something specifically, I do know that I was in energy that must have led me to feel that way, you know? I was so aware of gender dynamics at that age,
yeah.
You know, and because I knew that I was different, and I knew that, you know, even kids then would say like, oh, you act like a girl, or you're gay, and even at that age. And so that stayed with me for a while. And I just grew up like that, and really trying to make sense out of like, why does everyone think I'm gay? And like, also two people would call me a faggot. That was a word that people used even more than gay. It was like saying that I was a faggot. And that was a word that ended up really hurting me in my life. And I'm glad that I've done the work, and that word doesn't carry as much power over me as it used to. But back then it really hurt me. And I would just get it from everywhere. Literally, I could not go any space where people were just like, after a few minutes, they'd be like, you know, you act like a girl, you know, you're a faggot. And it just really hurt me. And so I was just like, what am I doing to make people think this? Like, from my perspective, I'm just being myself. I'm just living, you know, and existing. And so I grew up with that kind of that kind of stigma and that kind of, that rejection. I saw that as a rejection. It was like, no, like you can't be yourself. You can't be yourself. You can't be yourself. And so as I got older, I started molding myself into something that would protect me from being abused, you know? And so, it made me very insecure.
Yes.
And so it made me question myself. It made me question my sexuality as well. And like, I've had to go on my whole journey with sexuality, because ever since I can remember, people have been telling me that I was gay. So at some point you're like, oh, I must be gay. Like, if so many people from so many different spaces and walks of life are telling me this, then it must be true.
Yeah.
And so I've had to go on my own journey with that. And like, that's just been a whole thing. And like, you know, and it's just been so challenging and taxing, and you know, so I grew up very insecure. I got bullied all through school, to the point where when I was 13, I tried to kill myself. It was really tough, and things didn't start getting better for me until I was about 14 or so, and I found out I was had a really good talent for distance running, and I became a distance runner, and that thing started getting better for me then. But even then, it was really challenging. And
I'm just going to pause for a minute. Can you remember what was the shift for you?
Yeah, I remember this vividly. I remember the house we were in. I literally remember this like it was yesterday. I wanted to die. I didn't want to live, but I was afraid to die.
Yeah,
that kind of thing. I at 13, I had acquired so much abuse.
Oh.
That it just, I was like, I do not want to be here anymore, because I don't know how to
stop it,
deal with this and cope. And at that point, you know, I've had to have conversations with my family, because they also too attributed to that as well in their own way.
Yeah.
And so, I've gone to them and I've told them, they've apologized, you know, we've done that work and everything like that. But I just felt really misunderstood. Like, people didn't understand me. People didn't get me. And I really wish that I had someone who I could speak to, because I didn't speak to anyone. I didn't speak, even though people were calling me gay and calling me a fag, I didn't speak to anyone about like what was going on with me, you know? And like, and so I remember trying to kill myself when I was 13. The turning point for me was that something in me was just like, okay, no, we're not going to do this.
Mm.
What we're going to do is we're going to make something out of ourselves. And that was a conversation I had with myself at 13.
Wow, that's powerful.
I was like, we're going to make something out of ourselves, and we are going to make everyone who bullied you regret the day that they ever did that.
Yeah.
And I've always been very disciplined, and I've always been very driven and determined. That's something that has been like, innately, that is something that I just have a great propensity for. And so I was like, cool. At the time I was 13, I had braces, I was chubby, I was starting to get really bad acne. It wasn't a great situation for me. And also too, everyone thought I was gay and like calling me a faggot. So this was not, my life was not going how a 13-year-old would want it to go.
Yeah.
And I was just like, I just felt, I didn't feel attractive. I just, you know, I wasn't confident speaking to girls in that way, because everyone thought I was gay. So I was just like, I felt like I didn't have the right to even engage with women in that way or girls in that way, because I was just like, well, and also girls were calling me gay too. It wasn't just like it was a bit of everyone. So I was just like, I don't know where I fit. I was like, I don't think I'm gay, but like everyone's
saying, I don't know.
Yeah. Like, you know, at 13, I wasn't really giving myself that permission to really explore in that way.
Yeah.
And so I remember saying, okay, cool. We're gonna switch this whole thing up. We're gonna switch this up. And that's what happened. I remember I was 13. I started working out and going on runs around the neighborhood, and I started losing weight. And also too, at the same time, I started getting my growth spurt as well. So I grew, like, well, it was one summer that I just grew from, like, it had to be about like literally 5 or 6 inches. No word of a lie. I was like, literally, I was working out, and then I got my growth spurt. So I went from being this kind of on the shorter side, chubby guy to being this very tall, very lean guy who could just run for very long distances because I was working out. And then come to find out, I had a really good talent for distance running. And so in high school, I went out, my brother encouraged me to go out for the track team after I didn't make the basketball team, which is what I wanted to be. I wanted to be a baller. I was like, this is what I'm going to do.
But you're not tall enough.
Well, I, you know, at that point, I was tall enough. At that point, I was, because I was very tall then at 14. But I didn't, I don't think I had the, I was good, but I wasn't like super gifted in it. Okay. But I was very gifted in running. So when my brother said, why don't you go up the track team? At first I said no. Then I ended up going up to the track team. And that began my running career. And I spent 5 years from 14 to 19 running. I was an 8-time Maryland state champion.
Wow.
Four-time All-American, U.S. national champion with the fastest time in the country with my relay team.
What was your event, 100 meters or 400?
800, actually.
800?
Middle distance.
Which relay? The 800 as well? No, the 400.
Four by eight. Yeah. So in high school, you have 4x8. They don't do 4x. I don't know if they do
4x4.
They do 4x4. They do 4x1, 4x2, 4x4s. They even do like the, it depends. In like high school and university, they do like DMRs. They do, yeah, all that. But and they do 4x8s as well. And okay. So that was my thing. I was an 800 meter runner. And I had a lot of success with it. I got a full ride scholarship to a variety of different universities. I ended up going to Hampton University in Virginia. And at that time, I wanted to run in the Olympics for Team GB. Even though I was in the States, I wanted to run for Team GB because I graduated high school in 2008. And the next Olympics was in 2012 in London. And I was like, oh, this is perfect. I'm going to this is going to be great. And so I had a great career. And what that did for me is that it changed the narrative a bit for me. Now people really respected me. And so that shifted things. Well, people were still talking about me. People were still speculating about me, but it wasn't so much to my face because they were like, no, that guy is going somewhere. Mm-hmm. And so running really saved me in that way. But to be honest, I never really dealt with the issues. They were still there. I was still having the challenges in high school, and people were still worse. Like, I still had a not so great time in high school in regards to like people speculating and of that about me, but it was better. And I really loved running. And then I got to university and I wanted to run the Olympics, and that was the trajectory I was on. But I never really dealt with the issues from growing up. Mm. And so in high school, it was very disciplined. My coach was like my father, like the track team was like my family. We went to school, we ran, repeat. And it was just da-da-da-da-da, you know, like, and we had great success. And that was great. When I got to university, it was so much more like you were meeting so many different people from so many different walks of life. And you're like, oh, you know, you're starting to party a bit more and stuff like that. And I had never, like I said, I never dealt with the issues. And I want people to understand that because I never really dealt with these issues. Yes. And there's a variety of different reasons why I started falling out of love with running, because that's what happened. I didn't want to compete anymore. Because for a variety of different reasons, one, the coach who recruited me got fired. So I had this new coach who I didn't really get on with that well. But also too, I wanted to explore more of who I was. I was like, I'm not just this athlete. I'm actually, there's more to me than this. But also too, there were things going on internally with my sexuality and all these different things of like, okay, like what's going on with me? Because now that I'm at university, you know, there are openly gay people there. There are there are all these different things. And it's like, you know, and there are all these, like, you know, we were partying and like, and also too, I got introduced to drugs for the first time when I was in university. And that was the beginning of my 5-year battle with substance abuse. So at university, I started doing drugs, and literally I struggled with drugs for 5 years after that. Mm. So after my first year at university, I gave up my scholarship. I I dropped out of university and I just started traveling around the States. I was in LA for a year and that's where I got into the creative industry. And then ultimately ended up moving back to Bristol in 2010. My drug use continued. Actually, it got worse in Bristol. If anyone knows about Bristol, it's a big drug city, big party city. I do love this city, but there is definitely a
dark side. Drugs. Yeah.
There's definitely 100%. And I mean, I've almost died twice here. And my friends have, it can really take you. It really can take you. Actually, the Bristol will do it. You know, if you allow it, Bristol will take you out of here. But my drug use got worse because I never dealt with these issues. And ultimately, there was this big theme of sexuality that I never really had taken care of.
Yeah.
And I didn't know how to go about navigating through it. I did not know how to, what do you even do? How do you even find out? There's no conversation around this at all. And you can't really go up to people and speak about this. This was like in the 2000s. That wasn't happening. So there was a lot of inner turmoil I had, and I just felt really insecure. I was still that very insecure 5-6-year-old inside, who had masked a lot of that through his accomplishments.
Yeah.
So yes, I had managed to not kill myself and make something out of myself. But in return, I had really deflected any type of inner work because everything was about achieving. Everything was about performance. And if I perform, then I'm proving that I'm good enough. You know, I'm not just dumb faggot that everyone thought I was. I'm doing something. And also it was my way of getting back at people. Yeah. It was saying, you called me a faggot, but I'm going to a full ride. I don't know. I'm going to university on a full ride. Where are you going? Community college. And that's what I would say in my head. Now I would smile and people were like, I wouldn't ever say it. But in my head, I was like, screw you.
That's the energy behind it. It's like drinking your own poison.
Exactly. And everything is about, performance. And, so I was dealing with all that. And when I moved back to Bristol in 2010, I was still very much dealing with that and struggling with all of that. And it made me take drugs even more. And I got into such a dark spot. Like I said, I almost died a couple of times. And so 2013 is when I got clean. And then not too long after that, I ended up starting Milk for Tea. To support other men who are dealing with mental health issues, et cetera.
I'm going to pause.
Go for it.
Did you ask for help or did it get to the point where that was no longer a choice?
So I wouldn't say that I was addicted. Even though I had a really tough time kicking it and everything, I wouldn't necessarily say I was addicted. I just had a very unhealthy relationship with it.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't ask for help because I didn't want help. I loved drugs. Fell in love with drugs. I was not trying to get help from this. This was my savior. I was insecure. These drugs helped me feel confident. I didn't feel like I had a lot of friends. This drug, when you're on drugs, everyone's your friend. This drug was magic to me. And I was like, I want this. And also too, I was just young and having a good time as well. I did have some very fun and good times too, but no, I didn't end up asking for help. My brother was very concerned for me.
Okay.
And so having his concern, other people who were just very concerned, I was losing so much weight. And but I'm not that big to begin with.
It's noticeable.
It's
when you
very noticeable. I was a stick. I was so thin. And that was what made my brother so worried. Because I remember one time I was getting changed and he came into my room. And he literally looked at me and I saw his face drop because he was just and my brother is not a very serious person. He's very jovial, he's very comedic and funny, but his face was so serious. And he was just you're going to die. You're going to die. I can see your heart beating. And I was I couldn't see it because along with all of this, I also had a little bit of body dysmorphia because
of course,
from being back when I was chubby. And so I liked being skinny, to be honest. I liked it. I was like, it's better than being chubby. I was like, this is better, And so I couldn't see. I actually thought that I wasn't thin. I actually was like, I need to actually work out more and stuff like that.
Yeah.
When I look at pictures from back then, I'm like, oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Of course.
What happened was I ended up getting to some really, really low points. I mean, like many people, I had to hit rock bottom a couple of times.
Yeah.
And that was kind of what helped me wake up a bit. And then I started connecting spiritually again. I And that was really like kind of what helped change it for me is, just connecting spiritually. And then that was kind of my journey of recovery, is connecting spiritually. And then that kind of led me to like not doing any drugs anymore and turning and leaving that lifestyle behind.
Mm. And then you started Milk for Tea, and that was in Bristol.
That was in Bristol. And I started that in the end of 2014. And then I did that. I ended up doing my TEDx talk in October of 2015, November 2015. I'm sorry. I was also with the Prince's Trust, who was supporting me with the company.
Yeah.
And just did that as well. You know, I had a great time. Was able to meet Prince Charles a couple of times actually, and do some very cool things and meet some great people. And a lot of doors were open for me. And so. And then I just got in the trajectory of working with Milk for Tea, and what we ended up doing, you know, I had a business partner at the time, and we worked with companies to support their team members and worked on transforming their cultures in there. And so we worked on transformational programs around diversity, inclusion, mental health and well-being, leadership, gender equality, et cetera. So it was a great time. And I really learned a lot about structural change, systemic change, systems change, within the corporate space and the corporate landscape, and understanding how that works, how it can work. Also, too, I also learned that a lot of companies talk about it but don't actually want to do it. And
that is, you know what? I'm going to park that. Yep.
So, and I actually want to say that that is the majority of companies.
Yep.
Like they talk about it, and especially now that we're like in BLM and all this stuff, like people talk a good game, but I'm telling you, you start telling them what they really need to do, and it's like, all right. Thank you for your time.
And bye.
Bye. All right now. Invoice us. See ya.
Let's not park it. Whilst we're here, I was writing a note to come back to it, but let's stay here.
Let's go
for it. I'm laughing because absolutely that is my experience as well. Mm. And I think just to expand on that, so many people think that change is, that systemic change, let me name it, is something that can be done when you're told what to do, follow a few instructions, tick a few boxes, and that you, Daniel, you must come in and teach everybody how to do it. And if they don't change, then it's your fault. There is a lack of understanding about what is required on an individual level first and then a collective level. I mean, I've been into some violent, hostile spaces.
I can imagine. I'm sorry to hear that. I'm so sorry to hear that.
Thank you. But it is, it's like actually what's required is ongoing, and it's huge, and it's confronting, and it's not always easy, but either you want systemic change or you don't.
Or you don't. And a lot of companies don't.
And
they say they do, but through their actions, they don't. Yeah. And it's about holding people accountable through their actions. And particularly with last year in BLM, all these companies and people saying, we're going to change, we're going to do this, we're going to do that. Look, I've been Black my whole life. Those types of, like, that type of stuff does not inspire me. That type of stuff does not impress me. No. I want to see change through action, you know? And I'm sorry you had to deal with that. And I can only imagine what that's like being, not only just being Black, but being a Black woman as well. And like in those spaces. And I'm sorry that you were not protected in those spaces. And I'm sorry that you were even had to be in those spaces doing other people's work in that way, you know?
Thank you.
And I'm sorry that like we have as Black people, and it's the same thing for other people of color and Indigenous people as well. The fact that we are in this system and this space where we are having to do other people's emotional and inner work for them. You know, and us being scapegoated a lot of the times when it doesn't necessarily map out, particularly in the corporate space.
Yeah.
I'm sorry that you had to deal with that.
Thank you for saying that. I received that. Thank you. I'm gonna segue into healing, and then I'm gonna come back to your experience in the States and here. But the healing part, just because it's present for me now, it is the biggest component. And that's what I say to people who actually want to engage in systemic change.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly, you know, my lens is anti-racism, but actually how I'm teaching and what I'm teaching is about healing. So you can essentially apply everything that I'm teaching you into every other facet of your life.
Mm-hmm.
And it is what makes it so violent is that there are too many individuals in the world who are either not able because they don't have access, or what is being provided is not sufficient, are not engaging in their healing work.
Yeah, it's healing is where it's at. And that's what I'm doing now. And so I would say with Milk for Tea, I was doing that in a way. But now that I've transitioned outside of Milk for Tea and I'm working independently, you know, through the work that I do individually, but also too with Race and Gender, which is Race and Gender Unfiltered, which is my podcast, but also just the different work that I do. You know, I've got a film as well. My first feature length documentary, which is called Race and Gender Unfiltered as well, under the same name. And it's looking at social change through social healing, you know?
Oh,
and
lovely.
And so I'm really excited about that. But that's the work that I do now. You know, it's all about social healing. And I'm really enjoying this work. But one thing I have to constantly remind myself is that everything that I do now, whether it's the podcast, the documentary, or working with companies, you know, in diversity, inclusion, or whatever it may be, or speaking and doing workshops, all of that is a reflection of the work, the inner work that I do personally.
100%.
Nothing is more important than my own personal work.
Yeah.
Because those are just reflections. Those are just manifestations of the work I'm doing. And so for me, I've had to really be intentional about honoring my process, taking time to do my work. You know, I had some pieces of work lined up in March that I was supposed to do, and I postponed all of them because I was like, I'm in a space right now. I have to focus on my healing right now. And there are certain things that are coming up for me. I have to make room. I have to make space.
Yeah.
I'll get to you in April when I have a bit more capacity to do, but I have to, my higher self is calling me to do this right now.
Nice.
And sometimes, you know, we want to do the projects and we want to do the things that are very sparkly and we want to do things that are really like cool and sexy and good looking and like, but this work is not good looking. This work is not, this work is not hot. Okay. This work is not hot. It is grueling, arduous at times, challenging, dark.
Yep.
It is like literally like back breaking. Like transformation is like, you know, and when people hear the word transformation, I think sometimes it's like we want to transform. It's like we just want like this like sparkly dust to like come over us and we want to be transformed. But actually, it's like completely reshaping our skeletal structure and like it's breaking our spine in half and rebuilding rebuilding a new form and entity altogether. You know, it's our skin, you know, rips back and a new one emerges and it's a shedding and unlayering and unbecoming. And it's a process. And that's what I've realized more. And that's where I'm at right now as we speak. I'm in that right now.
Yeah.
And but that's really, you know, where we have to go. And so when we talk about companies and most people, they're not willing to do that work. Like,
no.
They're like, come on. Like, most people aren't even aware. People aren't even operating on that
level.
Frequency. Yeah. No, not at all. Like, and so, but that's the work that's required. That is the work that is required. And you have to face yourself and the parts of yourself that you want people to know about and the parts of stuff that you feel ashamed about.
Yep.
All of it.
And that's the thing, because, there are some who want to heal but don't have access to healing. Some who want to heal but can't get access to healing that is adequate for the needs or their trauma. Yeah. And then there's those who don't think that it applies to them. And then there's those who just don't want to. And then you've got all these different, you know, all these different approaches or entry points in the workplace, which is made up of lots of different individuals from different backgrounds. And that's the reality. So many will come to me and say, well, Nova, can you come in and do a workshop for our senior managers on anti-racism? To achieve what in half? What do you expect me to achieve in half a day with your senior managers? Like, where are your expectations? Are your senior managers, do they want to have a conversation with me about their shame, about racism and their racism? Because I suspect that they don't. That's what I'm talking. Like, that's the work I'm doing. It's not what I used to do, but that's the work I'm doing now. And we've been so conditioned to... not even just conditioned, but sometimes not able to be ourselves, like who we are in our essence at work. And then you want to bring in anti-racism, well, if you understand what anti-racism is in its essence, then you'll understand that this is systemic change, this is cultural change, and this is healing work. And that means that there is going to be some very challenging conversations, or at least you need to start cultivating a space where that can be held at the very least.
These companies, honestly, a lot of these companies just make me laugh. Like, you know, and probably similar to you, you know, they'll message you and stuff like that. And you just be like, you know what? You don't even know what you're asking.
You don't even
know what you're asking for. Like, you have no idea. Like, and like, sometimes I'm like, some of these companies are so big that I'm like, you know what? To do this work, you would have to completely dismantle your whole company and start from the ground up, because that's just how ingrained and insidious it is. And so like, yes, you can reform, and yes, you can make progress, but the reality is, like, a lot of these companies, literally, like, you have to, it's the work is inside out, like, you know, and it's like, people want equity and equality, but then it's like, but you have no plans of changing your senior management team. Yeah. How does that work?
Yeah.
Like, people don't recognize the price of what they're asking for. People want to, you know, and there are people who generally don't recognize it. And there's some people who don't, like, they just want a tick box exercise. So
absolutely, because they benefit and they continue to benefit from, actually, I'm just doing this because it's not going to look good if we don't. So
exactly.
So, you know, there's been some lessons I've learned on the way along the way. And as a result of that now, Daniel, I say no more than I say yes. I have very, very few number of corporations that I will work with, and I will work in a very slow and strategic way. Otherwise, it's just you end up rewounding and just not achieving change. And for me, it's about change, not ticking a box and telling people what words to say. That's not the work.
Of course. And I think people need to recognize as well. And first of all, thank you for sharing that. And congratulations on getting to that point.
Thank you. You know what I've gone through to get there.
I know. And it's a lot of disappointment and hurt.
Yeah.
And what people don't recognize is that, and I think, and I particularly, I, you know, I really, for all those listening who are white, and I really want you, to, those listening, and to know how much it takes for Black and other people of color and Indigenous people to get in front of their oppressors, people who are in the oppressing group, and tell them the truth of their experience, and also support them in helping to dismantle their racism.
Yeah.
It re-traumatizes us often to do this work. And so it takes so much to have any Black person get in front of you and even do this work at all. What they've had to go through to get to that point, honestly, it's just so much beyond some people, I think, to even understand what it takes to do that. Yeah. And so, and oftentimes, you know, and so, yeah. And so anyone who is doing this work, make sure you're being taking care of yourself and you're protecting your well-being, and make sure that you're getting paid and paid to a level that you need to get paid at to be re-traumatized, because that's what it takes.
And get your therapy and your, you know, I have clinical supervision every week or every 2 weeks, depending on my diary, but like I have to invest in constantly looking after my emotional, physical and mental health, because we're not immune. Just because we've got skills and you know, have been called to serve in this way, it doesn't mean that somehow we're immune from constantly dealing with people's racism. So especially in the workplace, because that's where I find you. When I say the workplace, I mean a corporate environment. That's often where you get the most wounding, rather than people who actively choose to engage in this work. There's two sets of people there. So there's something I want to talk to you about. Obviously, summer last year, for me, it was just this, you know, this cult. Nothing was new, of course, for us, Daniel, but this culmination of events of violence on Black bodies, just compounded by the exposure of the inequalities or the existing inequalities that were being magnified by the pandemic.
Mm-hmm.
And then this trauma and patrol and violence on these bodies, and then George Floyd, and then, you know, so many non-Black people waking up to our reality, and the resurgence of BLM. And then I saw you leading in Bristol, and if you want to share a little bit more about how that was for you.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, I know.
So yeah, last year was one of the most challenging times, I want to say, of my life, actually. Yeah, wow. Of my entire life. On so many different levels. One, we're in a pandemic. Like, yeah. You know, the world has shifted. Everything's, you know, but in the scheme of things, the pandemic was probably the last of my worries, like, to be honest. Yeah. I was just like, I mean, I would take a pandemic over racism any day.
100%.
Like, any day. So it was tough, you know, like, being in this pandemic. And then also, you know, like, again, just having this new iteration of BLM happening last year. At first, it was Ahmaud Arbery. And then it was Breonna Taylor.
Yep.
And then it was George Floyd. And it was just like, I remember when it was Ahmaud Arbery. And I was just like, I messaged some of my friends, my Black friends. I said, is it bad that I don't want to engage?
Yes.
Like, is it bad that I don't, like, I was like, I don't have this. Like, we are in a pandemic. Like,
I do not have it in me.
I don't have this. I don't have this to, like, do. And, like, I cannot do this. I cannot. And they were like, no, just do your thing. And then it was Breonna Taylor. And then I was like, okay, I need to engage. And then it was George Floyd. And it was like, okay, I have to engage. We got to do this. And so it was tough. There was so much, because it's the stuff that brings up for you. So it triggers us individually.
Yeah.
And so you're dealing with your own trauma, your own wounding, your own everything, mental health, emotional well-being. But then you also carry the collective. You also carry that for the collective. And it's like, as Black people, you know, and African people, we come from community-based, you know, spaces. Yes. Our culture is community-based. Mm-hmm. I can't speak for all these other Western European, I can't speak for them. I'm going to speak for us as African. I know, and it's the same for many other people of color and Indigenous people.
Yes.
I know that's something that we share within the BIPOC community.
Yes.
But, you know, but in the Black community, we're community-based. We're family. And what happens with one impacts us all, you know? And, like, we hold that. We hold that collective trauma. We hold it together. It's in our bodies. It is literally, as it speaks now, it is in our DNA.
Yeah.
It is like, and we have to do work to shift that and transform that, but it's in our bodies.
Mm-hmm.
Looking at Black people getting killed, full stop, regardless of who it's by, is traumatizing.
Yeah.
For them to be systemically killed off by white police officers is heinous beyond belief. And recognizing that they don't care. They do not care. And that's what, when Black people, when we're looking at that, it's not just seeing Black people killed by police. We're seeing Black people killed off by white police in a system that does not care amongst other white people who say they care but actually don't, aren't willing to do the work, recognizing that this has been our lived experience from the day we entered into this world and that most people actually don't really care. Mm-hmm. They can say all they want. They can say hashtag BLM all they want. But if you look at their actions, the majority of people do not care. And if they did care, we would not be in this situation.
Yes.
And that's the fact. I don't care how liberal, progressive you think you are. I don't care. If you are not doing this work to examine yourself and look at how you're contributing to the injustices of Black and Brown people, then you are not doing this work. You are not a part of the healing process. I don't care how you vote. I don't care who you voted for. I don't care that you like Michelle Obama. I like her too. That doesn't matter to me.
Yeah. Change matters.
Change matters and actions matter. And so, to go back to last year, being confronted yet again with the reality that most people don't care about Black people.
Mm.
Most people don't. Like, again, that's just fact. If you ask most people what they think about Black people, it's not going to be positive. Even now, even in 2021, it's not going to be positive. And understanding the injustice of that. The fact that people really act like Black people enslaved everybody else. Like, and like, people really go on like we did that to everyone else and like y'all coming back for revenge or something like that.
Yeah.
Y'all really acting like we did a madness.
Yeah.
And it's like
projections.
It's projections. And it's also too, it's the upholding of white supremacy and white privilege and white identity. Of what they believe their white identity is. And so many white people believe their white identity is, not all. And so it's upholding these structures. And so that was tough. But to be completely honest, Nova, one of the most gut-wrenching aspects of last year were the people who claimed to be my friend and were not one hand in this situation. That's really what did it. I've been Black my whole life. I've been called a nigga. Like, I've dealt with systemic racism. I've dealt with microaggressions. I deal with microaggressions on a daily basis. Like, and it doesn't make it, I'm not denoting or overlooking that, because those things impact me a lot.
Of course.
A lot. But I would say any day, I would rather someone call me an N-word on the street than have someone who claims to be my friend ignore their hands in my oppression and the oppression of my people. And not only that, I had white people who claimed to be my friend and my family.
Mm-hmm.
Who were not only not holding space for me to bring up issues of racism within our relationship, but then said, not only am I not going to hold space for you to bring up racism, how dare you bring up racism in our relationship?
Yes.
How dare you?
Yeah.
And because of that, I'm not going to speak to you.
Yeah.
That was my lived experience.
Yeah.
I had someone who claimed to be my best friend.
Oh, Daniel.
My best friend.
I am, you know what? I'm gonna pause here. I want people listening to let this land. Because everything you are saying, Daniel, is a carbon copy of what has happened to others and what have happened to me. And it is painful. It is so wounding when you are in your lived experience and your trauma, like you've just spoken. It's not, you know, when there is, let's talk specifically about the summer last year, the crescendo, as I like to describe it, that was George Floyd. When you're a person, it's not just your personal trauma you're dealing with. You're dealing with historical trauma, you're dealing with intergenerational trauma, and you're dealing with institutional trauma on top. The historical trauma, for me, Daniel, my hair fell out. Like, I never knew George or Armand Arbery or Breonna Taylor or Tony McDade, and yet my hair is falling out. And so this is the element that I really drive in for people who, you know, what can I do to help? What can I do to help? You have to unlearn your stuff.
Yeah.
And so for a friend to a best friend to suddenly think that you're not a man of integrity, that you're not someone that you clearly have been in relationship with and have loved and cared about one another, for them to come to the assumption that somehow your experience of the world and asking for them to be accountable for how their lack of engagement impacts you, that's not us saying you're a disgusting human being. That's us saying I care enough about this relationship for it to transform, and I am calling you in on this journey because I want to see it transform. But instead, how dare you I know.
I mean, you've articulated it so well, Nova. And it honestly, I want people listening to know how much it hurts. Like, and even now, how much it, like, it's, and I was literally here where I'm sitting right now. I broke down crying to my parents. I literally was crying in my dad's arms.
Aww.
Literally.
I'm so sorry.
I had journeyed with this person for years. Yeah. We were family.
Yeah.
His family was my family. I called his dad, dad. His sister was my sister. Like, this is family. Someone who was not supporting me all of last year.
Mm.
And don't get me wrong. There's other stuff as well. It's not just this. There's other dynamics going on.
Of course.
But, and what I said to him, I find it interesting with all that's going on in the world, particularly with the Black community, that this is how you're choosing to engage with me. That was not an attack. That was not you're a bigoted racist. I said, I find it interesting.
Yeah.
This is verbatim. That with all that's going on in the world, particularly with the Black community, that this is how you're choosing to engage with me.
Yeah.
You're not choosing to support me or encourage me, but you're saying that I disrespected you.
Mm.
His response, what you said about the Black community and Black Lives Matter is downright unjust and disrespectful.
Wow.
Because of how you have handled yourself, I can no longer engage with you personally, professionally, in any capacity whatsoever.
Wow.
And I am divesting fully from this relationship. You've lost a brother. You've lost a friend. This is the last time you're going to hear from me for a while. Goodbye. I want people to know this is not a far right extremist.
Yeah.
This is not a conservative. This is not even a moderate. This is a white, liberal, quote unquote, progressive.
Yeah.
That is who that is.
Yeah. Painful.
Painful. Painful on just a completely different level.
It's like going through a grieving process, actually.
It is grief. It is, completely.
Losing friends in that way. And almost, you know, having, essentially, this is the words I will use, having a part of your humanity rejected by them.
Someone you love.
Yeah.
Someone you love. And yeah. And then also, I want people to understand as well that he divested from the relationship.
Mm.
He divested. And also, so I want people to know that not only did he not hold space for me,
yeah,
but by doing what he did, he gaslit me. He made it seem like I was the problem. I was demonized. And that's what happens to a lot of people.
Yeah.
What he was unable to do was to look at himself,
yeah,
and the role that he plays as a white man in relationship to a Black man,
yeah,
and the different dynamics that are going on. He demonized me, which often happens. The person of color is demonized. We live in a time where it's worse to call someone a racist than to be racist.
Yeah, like, which is ludicrous.
Which is ludicrous. I was highlighting, I was bringing something to you,
yeah,
in a way that was honoring you and also in a way that you could hold that. Like,
and also honoring yourself, because what also we often do is swallow it because we, yes, know we'll get these responses. And you honoring yourself and giving that feedback is actually you holding a boundary and saying, this is not okay for me anymore.
Very much so. And I think that, and that is one thing I'm so glad for last year, even as tough as it was. Black people, we now have stronger boundaries. And
yeah,
I'm so proud of us for that.
Yeah.
And to every Black person listening, keep those boundaries strong and firm.
Yeah, they're for you. They're for you.
They're for you. Us. And that's what I had to do in my relationship. I said, this is my boundary. I'm not doing this anymore.
Yeah.
And so he gaslit me, which is in a form of emotional abuse.
It is.
And then he demonized me. And then he ejected himself. And by ejecting himself, he didn't have to do the work.
He
didn't have to look at anything.
Yeah. He's disengaging. He's making a conscious choice to disengage and bypass and place himself as the victim. Like cognitively, it's textbook behavior when you're working with anti-racism, with people feeling confronted. But when you're on the receiving end of it, it's so violent and so rewounding. And so, yeah, I'm sorry that happened to you.
Well, thank you, Nova. And that you said the word, it's emotional violence.
Yeah.
And this, and in this microcosm, it's a representation of what happens in the macro.
Yes.
Of like Black people and other people of color saying, this is the truth of my experience. And then people ejecting themselves and demonizing us. And it's like, come on now. And then also what happened as well is that I wasn't going to stoop down to that level. I held myself at my level. I said, look, I don't hate you. My response to his email, in which he has not responded to, and I don't expect him to, I don't hate you. I may not be a brother to you, but you are still my brother. And I said that you are still my brother.
Yeah.
And whenever you're ready to have this conversation, I will be here to have this conversation with you.
Yeah.
And I want people to recognize the level of integrity and standard that Black people oftentimes have to carry ourselves at.
Yeah.
Oftentimes have to. We don't get the privilege of going down that low. And oftentimes, particularly in the workplace.
Game over.
Game over. Game over. Like, we don't have that. We have to continually hold ourselves to a higher standard.
Mm-hmm.
And so the fact that anyone thinks they're superior to, like, is, anyway, that's a whole different conversation.
it's the irony of it. And this is why I always say, like, racism in its essence is just a bunch of projections. Like, it's like we're holding, just by merely looking at us and seeing our Black and brown skin can trigger guilt and shame and you know, huge responses in people that aren't ready to do the work. We are a reminder for them. And that's not ours, that's theirs. Like, we cannot take it on.
It's not ours to carry, and we will not carry it. And honestly, if white people, if you want to do the work, great, do the work. If not, I mean,
then don't pretend. Just get out the way.
And the fact that people and companies are profiting off of pretending like they're doing the work and pretending that they're caring, it's just the levels of and depths of exploitation just never end.
Yeah.
Never, ever end in this neo-colonial world. It just never end.
I would like to ask about collective healing. And firstly, what does collective healing mean to you? And to those who are listening who have heard, you know, snippets of your journey to healing and the work that you're doing now and might be afraid of, you know, doing work that isn't always pretty or that can be really painful, like what words of encouragement could you also share around that?
Yeah.
I'm
just going to take a quick moment to just ground myself, you know.
Yeah. Like,
you know.
I know, I'm moving you back and forth, yeah.
No, it's absolutely fine, you know.
Yeah.
I just want to make sure that I can articulate this in a way that that people can receive it and it land. Not that I'm tone policing myself, because I'm not going to do that. But I do want to make sure that I'm grounded for myself first and foremost.
Yeah.
Collective healing for me, I mean, it's as it says, you know, it's communal healing. It's not just healing for myself, but it's healing for my family, for my neighborhood, for my community, whether it's the Black community, et cetera. But in terms of what I mean by collective healing, it's healing for us as a society.
Yes.
You know, it's healing for, and so if we look at the UK, for instance, how do we heal as a country?
Yeah.
Like, what does that look like? And I'm telling you, that has very little to do with politics at all.
Mm.
Very little. Now, don't get me wrong. Politics can get into, when you start talking about on a systemic level and systemic inequalities, yes, you have to bring in legislation and policies. But we're not talking about that right now. We're talking about us as people, interpersonal, your next door neighbor across the street, your family, mother, brother, sister, father, your colleague, your coworker, all of that. It's healing for us on a civil level. Collective healing. How do we heal together?
Yeah.
How do we heal our communities? How do we heal our society? Mm-hmm. That's what collective healing means for me. And it takes, you know, like many things, it takes us starting with ourselves first. You cannot join in collective healing without having first initiated the work in yourself.
Yes.
You know, and that's how you add to the collective. So for instance, as I heal myself, I do add to the collective healing of, you know, so when you heal yourself, you're depositing into collective healing. You are, and communal healing. It first starts with ourselves, but then there also is intentional collective healing where it's like, okay, I'm now going to work along other people, whether it's people within my community, my family, or across communities. And we're going to do the work, healing work together.
Yeah.
And that's part of collective healing as well, is standing alongside other people and doing healing work together for
Being witnessed.
Being witnessed and witnessing, you know, and doing it for an expected end, you know, saying like, we're doing this because we want to progress the relationship that we have amongst each other.
Yeah.
You know, it's very intentional. You cannot do this work without being intentional. You cannot do this work. Ultimately, though, you cannot do this work without telling the truth. Full stop. That is the key to open this door.
Mm.
It's the key. The invitation is there. Telling the truth is the key.
Honesty is where it starts.
Honestly, you have to tell the truth. You cannot be a part of this and not tell the truth.
Yeah.
You can't. So to all those people who were putting black squares up on social media, who were saying hashtag BLM, to all these companies who were saying that they're going to do all this stuff, you recognize that you aren't engaged in this work if you are not telling yourself the truth.
Mm.
That's the first step. And then you also have to act on it. You have to be proactive, because then you have some people who are like, oh yeah, I know I have privilege. You know, when I see a black man walk towards me, I get really scared and I do this and I enact microaggressions, or, you know, I treat women really badly. They'll tell themselves the truth. They're telling the truth, but they ain't doing nothing with it.
Yeah, they're continuing.
It's just, it's all cerebral now.
Yeah.
And don't get me wrong, it's stages and phases. Don't get me wrong, but you have to know how to progress to the next part. And so for collective healing, it's very multifaceted, collective healing. And there are different people who are in different spaces of this field, if we're going to use that terminology. You know, there's a big roll call right now on embodied healing.
Yes.
And you know, and I love that. And I'm learning more about that. My friend and colleague, Josiane Smith, does so much incredible work in that. And I'm learning so much. Please write that down. Josiane Smith.
Thank you.
My gosh. She is someone who... If there are two people who I want to leave people with today, there are more than two. There are more than two. But if there are only two, They're two incredible women, of course.
Of course.
And two women I want to leave you with. And if you're listening, look them up. Jocelyn Smith and Maya Kalaria. Those two women right there, come on. Those two women right there. I am still standing here today in part because of their support, their guidance, their just them being who they are and really leading me and supporting me in this work.
Yeah.
Because they are, I really want to make this known, they are so skilled in this work. And it really speaks to what I believe needs to, the shift that needs to be happening right now. And it ties into your question about collective healing. As I mentioned before, you know, my family, we're doing some healing work right now.
Mm.
And in my family, I see how, as a man in this family, I need to make room for the women to do this, to lead in this healing work.
Wow.
I see how, as my role in this dynamic is to protect and create this container so that women can now do this work. Because the men, y'all part of the reason we're in this mess. Y'all are part of the reason we are in this mess. So it's like, and so it's not that you don't have a role in this, but your role is not the patriarchal role that you are accustomed to.
Mm.
And the role that we have all given to you, that's not your role right now. In reality, the men right now, you need to take a seat. Take a seat and hold the line and allow the women who are willing and wanting to do this work to lead us in this work.
Mm.
And that is what's happening right now in my family. And as a collective, I believe that's what needs to be happening more.
Mm.
It doesn't mean that men don't play any role. Men play a big and pivotal role in this. But you have to know right now, and from my perspective, we have a massive imbalance of masculine and feminine energy, masculine and feminine roles in this world. And you can see it throughout the world and a lot of different structures. I do believe that we need to be honoring the feminine right now. If we're looking at healing work, we need to be honoring particularly the women who are invested in this healing work.
Mm.
And I believe personally, my role as Daniel Edmond, as an individual, but also as a man, is to platform and support the women who are invested in doing this work and capable of doing this work to do that work and lead us in doing that work. I am being led by women to do this work. I do my own thing, but I'm saying the people who I go to, they're women. They're sacred women who honor the sacred feminine. And I go to them and I kneel before them, and not literally, but like I go before them as people who I'm going to for advice and counsel. What can I do? What should I do?
Yeah.
And women my whole life have guided me.
Mm.
And the reality is we are not honoring the feminine in our communities, in our families, in our workspaces. We're not doing that. And that is a big part of the reason why we are in the situations we're in today.
Yeah.
So for me, I honor the feminine, and I make space and room for the women in my life to lead in this way.
Mm.
And it doesn't mean that I don't lead at all. There are, sometimes we come across stuff where I'm like, actually, you know what? I'll step up. I'll lead this part. Lead this part. And yeah. I play my role, but it's a step up and then I step back and I continue to hold the line. I don't just stay in that position because I've been groomed and conditioned to think that as a man, I'm the central figure and main character of every story.
Yeah.
And that's something I've had to really unlearn, even up until recently. Like, Daniel, you are not the main character of every story. Mm-hmm. And just because, like, and this is coming from someone who really does honor the feminine. I still have work to do in terms of my ego, my male ego. I continually have to submit my male ego, continually have to deconstruct it, continually.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm so thankful, particularly to Maya Kalaria and Jocelyn Smith for just holding so much space for me. And there are many others. I don't want to make it just seem like there's just two, but these are two women in particular who are working very intentionally and very deeply in collective healing work and in grief and in trauma.
Lovely.
Even with my aunts that I'm speaking, and I just had, before this conversation, I just got off a phone call with my aunt, you know, because we're speaking about the healing work that's going on in my family. On Monday, I had another conversation with my aunt. And again, I'm going to them, the elders in my family, I'm going to them and I'm asking them for help. I'm asking them for support.
Nice.
And I'm honoring them by giving them this position in the family to do this work.
Yeah.
And I'm playing my role and they're playing their role. And I'm honoring them because I'm telling you right now, the more we degrade our women, the worse our conditions are going to get collectively. Mm. And also too, I want to say this for the Black community as well. this is part of our big wound that we have.
Yeah.
Now, every community has this wound, but I'm speaking specifically for the Black community right now. We have got to honor Black women. We have to lift them up. We have to support them. And I'm telling you, the more that we do that, the more that we're not only going to heal, but I'm telling you, our conditions are going to get better. And that's something that doesn't rely on anyone else outside of our community to do anything.
Correct.
That's stuff that we have. So honoring the sacred feminine, honoring that, I honor it. I kneel before it and I request of it. And I say, look, what role do I need to play to help this energy and these women facilitate the healing work that is so desperately needed?
Yeah.
And again, I honor the men in my life too. This is not saying that men don't have a role. Men, we play a pivotal and important role, like I said. But again, it may not be the role that you're used to playing.
Yes.
That is what I'm saying.
Yes.
This may not be the role that you're used to playing. And I'm telling you, you are going to have to check your ego at the door. You're going to have to check all your biases at the door, because we have got to do this work.
Yeah.
We have to. And if you think that a bunch of men are going to be the answer to this problem, I'm telling you now, I worked 6 years in men's well-being. I'm here to tell you, it ain't going to happen.
Mm.
It's not going to happen. We have got to all play our roles and honor each other.
Yes.
And like I said, it's a personal thing, but from my personal belief, we have got to make sure that we are intentionally honoring the sacred feminine and allowing women like yourself, Nova, to do this healing, to lead us in this healing work. You know, I'm doing a lot of different projects and I love what I'm doing. But again, part of me checking my ego is recognizing that, look, I do my own work and I'm working alongside, but I'm often being led by women. And it's the women who come before me, the women who continue to do this work daily. Maya Kalaria, she does this work daily.
Yeah.
If I call her right now, she'll processing
be doing
trauma.
It. Oh,
she's
absolutely
doing this work right now. As
absolutely
we speak, she's doing this work.
Absolutely. It's constant.
It's daily. It's constant. And I honor them. I honor all of the women, Nova, you included. I honor you all. And I thank you all for your contribution. And I apologize that we have not honored you all as men, the way that you all deserve to be treated and deserve to be honored and deserve to be platformed. And honestly, the retribution for that is literally the situation we all find ourselves in to this day.
Wow.
That this is our retribution for that. And I firmly believe this, and people don't have to agree with me, that's fine. Mm. Our retribution is the state of the world as it is today. And I'm telling you, we just have to, again, honor the feminine, honor it. And I'm telling you, we can heal. We can heal. I'm telling you, we will heal. There are women particularly I see right now. I feel it in my bones and I feel it in my spirit. There are women right now who are so strategically placed to lead us in this healing so well.
And so many Black women as well.
So many Black women. So many Black women. Well, we have to make room. We have to make room. And again, that means as men, we may not be the main character and we don't need to be the main character.
Mm.
We may just need to set up some chairs. We may just need to set up a Zoom call. We may just need to put some finances towards something.
Yes.
We may just need to platform and hold space and do our own work.
Yes.
We don't always have to be, again, and this is coming from someone, you know, I grew up, you know, my dad's a pastor, my grandfather's a pastor, my great-grandfather's a pastor. Yeah. I come from a long line of Christian pastors. And so in many ways, and I grew up listening and reverencing and honoring Martin Luther King Jr. and, you know, all the great men, you know, who came before
yes
me as ancestors and women as well, of course. And I've shared that already. But and then you have former President Barack Obama, you know, and all these other Martin Luther King, Malcolm X and Huey P. Newton and Marcus Garvey and all these men. And over time, you know, even me, and I'm someone who I've always gravitated towards the feminine, honored the feminine. But even me, I'm recognizing at 30 years old, the conditioning I've had of like this being the male central figure.
Yeah.
The face of this, the face of a movement is this.
Yeah.
You know, the central figure is this. The most important role is this. And even me, I bought into it, even without knowing. I bought into it. And me, part of the work I'm doing right now, and I'm saying this is very recently, it's like I was on a phone call with another friend of mine earlier this week. And I said, I'm noticing that I'm recognizing that my role is changing and shifting.
Yes.
In this, it's not what I thought it was, because as great as MLK is, as great as all these men have been, even my father, grandfather, and great grandfather, as great as it is highly patriarchal.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is, that is, I don't believe that that is what this time is calling for right now.
Mm.
And so for me, I recognize that my role is shifting. It doesn't make it any less important.
No.
It just looks different. It's a reimagining of what my role and my contribution to the collective and collective healing is.
And it's, and it's being open to it shifting and also surrendering to it shifting.
It's a massive surrender.
Yeah.
It is a massive surrender. And again, men, again, we have to be intentional about this because, like I said, it's in all of us.
Mm.
And even those of us who, like I said, think we have great relationships with women and who do have great relationships with women, we all have work to do. And so, and to the white people listening, it's the same way, you know, all white people have work to do, whether you are liberal, progressive, how it doesn't matter. You all have work to do. As a man, I always have work to do.
Yeah.
You know, and so I have to make sure I'm doing my work and I am surrendering to my role changing in this, you know? And that is something, again, it's an unlayering. I have to let go of these kind of ideals and like outlines and formats that I'm used to and accustomed to and let go of that and say, okay, cool. This is what my role looks like. This is where I'm best placed right now and allow people to do the work that they need to do so we can all heal.
Beautiful and very humbling and powerful way to end it. I actually felt quite emotional listening to you say that a few times. So there's a part of me that needed to hear that from a man. Thank you. I didn't know I needed to hear that. And thank you. There was something that you said, and it was at the beginning of our conversation and also at the end. So I think it's a beautiful way to end about something about these women who I will link in the show notes who have, some of the women who are leading you with your healing. And the reason why is because they've been given the space and they are allowed to be who they are. And there was something that you said at the beginning about, you know, you weren't allowed to be who you are. And when you were allowed to be who you are and have started to go on your own healing journey, that's impacting how you show up in the world. So the more of us who get to be who we are in our essence and have that nurtured and celebrated and honored, just imagine the ripple effects that happen in the world.
Oh.
So, yeah.
And I want to add another name to that, Rachel Edmond, my aunt. My Rachel aunt, who I just got off the phone with, Rachel Edmond, she, powerful, powerful. I mean, there's too many women to name.
And no,
I
almost it's okay.
I almost feel bad for naming any because I'm like, oh, I'm going to miss them out. But those are three women in particular that I'm just like, right now, are just who have been supporting me for so long. And you articulated that so well. And I think I just want to just respond to what you've just shared. And again, it's living our truth.
Yeah.
And that is so much of it is living our truth and the healing that comes from living our truth and the transforming power that is in living our truth.
Yeah.
Not only do we honor ourselves, but we honor our ancestors as well. Many of whom did not get to live their truth. And we honor them. And as we close, I just want to honor our ancestors, our African ancestors in this moment and thank them for their contribution so that we could even have this conversation, Nova.
Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you for them. I honor your ancestors that come from your lineage as well as mine. And also I honor the ancestors that we share as African people in our community. And we honor them. I thank them. And Nova, I honor and I thank you for this platform. I thank you for your contribution to the collective, the never ending, tireless work that you do. Thank you. And I just am so honored to be here in this space. And thank you so much.
Daniel. An absolute pleasure and a privilege. Thank you.
So there you have it. No stone left unturned. Rich conversation, deep. And I know that those topics may have been stirring for you. Those topics are also human. So I cannot thank Daniel enough for sharing so much of his heart with me. And thank you for tuning in. You can connect with Daniel over on his Instagram, Daniel Edmond, that's Edmund. And you can also support the work that he does over at Race and Gendered Unfiltered, his own podcast, and look out for his documentary in the same name. What I will do is I will also add a link in the show notes to the women of colour that Daniel wanted to honour in this episode, so you can check out the incredible work that they are doing in the world as well. And as ever, if this episode has stirred something in you and you want to lean into your anti-racism journey and learn more, gain deeper knowledge, unlearn, relearn, so you can transform, my anti-racism course, Becoming Anti-Racist with Nova Reid, is ready and available to you if you're feeling like you want to lean in more. I will leave a link in the show notes, as well as my debut anti-racism book, The Good Ally. Pre-orders are available right now and they are deeply appreciated. So thank you again for sitting with and being with any discomfort and showing up for the work. As you can tell by my conversation with Daniel, we have much work to do. And thank you for being here. You know what to do. If this episode has resonated with you, please hop on over to your podcast host and leave a review. Until next time, please take great care of yourself. I'll see you soon.